You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we learn about a project that's trying to track Wisconsin wildlife using trail cameras around the entire state.
First, Donald Trump held a contentious press conference yesterday addressing concerns over his donations to veterans groups. At issue, $6 million Trump claimed was raised during a January fundraiser and donated to veterans charities.
But in the last few weeks, questions have been raised about how much money was actually raised and donated by Donald Trump, leading the presidential candidate to announce some donations this week. Trump said he did not want credit for trying to help American troops, but also blasted the media for not giving it to him. And he also angered some veterans in the process who say they don't want to be political props for any candidate.
Here with us now to talk more about Donald Trump, veterans, and politics is Peter Feaver. He's professor of political science at Duke University and the director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with this idea of veterans as a political prop. Some veterans have accused Donald Trump of using them as a political prop with his fundraiser earlier in the year. And now some people responded to media criticism of him by saying, media, you're using veterans as a way to attack Donald Trump. What do you make of this back and forth over veterans on the political stage here?
Well, veterans have always been a part of our political process and all the way back to the wake of the Civil War, when American veterans would literally wave the bloody shirt to argue for greater veterans' benefits, and this played a major role in presidential and local campaigns. So veterans have been a powerful political force for the last 100-plus years, and it's no surprise that they are salient in the 2016 election as well.
This story started when Donald Trump decided not to attend a Fox News Republican presidential debate and had this fundraiser instead. How did that strike you as a genuine effort? I mean, I know you can't read Donald Trump's mind, but did it look like a sincere effort to help veterans, a political stunt, or some combination of the two?
Well, it was obviously a political stunt, but it was a clever one. It was one that instead of the story being Donald Trump's afraid to debate his rivals, the story was, look how Donald Trump has turned the tables on his rivals. But there's really three threads to this story. One is Donald Trump's penchant for personalizing everything. So he immediately personalized the criticisms from the press, calling out individual reporters and accusing them of having a vendetta against him, which is ironic because he was expressing his vendetta against them. The second thread, though, was Trump's penchant for making bold boasts that don't really stand up when you examine them closely, whether it's boasts of how smart he is or what he's accomplished in the past. In this case, boasts about how much money he had personally given, and turned out that he had exaggerated how much money was raised and he had exaggerated how much money he had given. And then, of course, the third thread is his own personal relations with the veterans, which has been rocky. Very early on in the campaign, he took what many consider to be a career-ending vicious attack on Senator McCain. Turned out not to hurt Trump as much as many people, including myself, thought it would, but it nevertheless put Donald Trump on the wrong side of an issue with many veterans. And I think he's been carrying that baggage ever since.
Talking to Professor Peter Feaver about Donald Trump, veterans, and politics. Now, looking at veterans themselves and voting, is there such a thing as a veteran's vote, or is being a veteran just one part of that particular voter's identity in addition to, I know, their job, their ideology, their geography, and a lot of other things?
Well, of course, it's just one part of a composite. But veterans do tend to cluster on certain issue areas. They tend to be a little bit more conservative than non-veterans. They tend to approach questions about the use of force and how a commander-in-chief should behave a little differently than non-veterans. And, of course, they care passionately about veterans' benefits. And so it does make sense to talk about a veteran's vote, even though no block is monolithic. Now, this one favors Trump, but modestly by historical standards. So his advantage on the polls that have been done thus far, Trump's advantage with veterans is modest. but it's real.
I've seen different arguments how veterans approach the use of military force issue you just mentioned. Some people have said, well, it's a matter of they support the military and military spending and military deployments when they happen. I've also seen people argue that people with military experience tend to be more cautious. They don't like wild use of military force or threats of injudicious use of military force. What do you see?
Both are true. So the veterans tend to favor using force rarely but decisively. So they don't want they oppose incremental uses of force that are half-hearted, halfway measures that don't work. The infamous escalation of Vietnam, for instance. But they do say if you're going to use it, then go massively. This was famously articulated by General Powell as the Powell Doctrine. Rarely, but decisively.
Now, we start off talking a little bit about the use of veterans as props. Does how a candidate talks about veterans, raises money for veterans in this case, influence how the rest of the voting public thinks of them?
Well, support for veterans is a classic valence issue. That is to say, candidates rarely line up on opposite sides. You don't get a candidate who says, well, I oppose veterans. In the same way, other issues like abortion or Supreme Court justices, the ideology of Supreme Court justices, you can get a debate on either side. A valence issue, candidates are competing with each other to show how much they love them, like mom and apple pie. And so what Donald Trump was doing, the way he politicized the veteran support issue this time is very traditional for a political candidate. What was unusual was him promising to give his own money and then failing to do so until he was called out by the Washington Post on it. That's what made this an unusual story. But claiming to support the veterans and saying, you know, bragging about how much he supports the veterans in general, that's pretty standard fare for politicians. And in this regard, Donald Trump is very much like any other politician.
It's too soon to see any polling on this since that press conference yesterday. But do you think that this could end up hurting Donald Trump, the storyline that he didn't donate money that he said he would donate? At one point, it looked like his campaign was saying he had donated until he was called on it by the media.
Well, I've lost confidence a little bit in my ability to predict what will hurt Donald Trump. I would have thought many of the things, the gaffes and mistakes he's made up till now would have hurt him more. I will say it probably has hurt him, though. Donald Trump is the nominee, and he won despite many people's predictions that he wouldn't win. But he won with a very small percentage of the vote. He's the weakest, in terms of broad Republican support, he's the weakest Republican candidate we've had in recent years. And so clearly Donald Trump has not unified the Republican Party. He does not have broad appeal, and he has the highest negatives of any modern candidate. In that case, I would say all of those point to the self-inflicted wounds that he's done, and I think this is one more of those self-inflicted wounds that's likely going to hurt his effort to broaden his appeal.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Peter Fever. He's professor of political science at Duke University and the director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Thousands of trail cameras, satellites, and crowdsourced databases are set to track all kinds of Wisconsin wildlife.
Snapshot Wisconsin kicked off earlier this month, and it brings together the state DNR, UW-Madison researchers, and NASA to try to create an accurate and complete picture of the state's animal populations.
Most of the cameras have been deployed in southwestern Wisconsin so far, but more will be added over time, and residents can even get involved with their own trail cameras.
Jennifer Stengline and Phil Townsend joins us now. Jennifer is a research scientist with the Wisconsin DNR and one of the leaders of Snapshot Wisconsin. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Phil Townsend is a UW-Madison professor of forest and wildlife ecology and another leader of the Snapshot Wisconsin project. Phil, welcome to you.
Hi.
Well, Phil, let's start with you. Can you explain how Snapshot Wisconsin is going to work?
Well, basically, the DNR is working with private citizens across the state to get trail cams into their hands and out onto their property. We want to cover the whole state. these citizen scientists will then monitor the cameras and upload the photos that are triggered by motion. They'll upload those photos to a website. That's the snapshotwisconsin.org website. That's through Zooniverse. And there, the crowd, people all across the world, will classify what animals are in those photos, because we're going to be getting hundreds of thousands and millions of photos, and we can't look at them all ourselves. Then that provides us with our data about where animals are, when they're there, and how many of them there are there, which will then link to maps that come from NASA imagery, maps of vegetation type, its distribution, when vegetation is greening up, where crops are, things like that, to build maps of where animals are based on what the landscape looks like in different places across the whole state.
And Jennifer, how important do you imagine this could be in getting an accurate picture of the state's animal populations and also the way that Wisconsin greens up in the spring?
Yeah, so one thing Snapshot Wisconsin really does is increase our extent of monitoring across the state, and I think that's a real benefit to it. So a lot of the monitoring that we already have going on might be in just the northern part of the state or during a certain time of the year. And what Snapshot Wisconsin does is it gives us a broader picture and a more consistent picture for all types of wildlife all across the state and all throughout the year. And so the question of green up, that's a great one. These cameras are programmed to take one time-lapse photo every day at about 11 a.m., and that picture is taken no matter if wildlife walks in front of the camera at that time or not. And so we get a picture every day, and so we can track things like the greening up of vegetation in the spring and then the browning down in the fall. And those are some of the parameters that that our NASA collaborators are especially interested in to help us link to animal populations in Wisconsin.
And Phil, speaking of NASA, how did Snapshot Wisconsin get NASA on board with this?
Well, NASA is really interested in the data that they collect being used for more than just science, I would have to say. NASA had an opportunity for people to suggest programs where NASA imagery, there's so much imagery that they collect over the Earth that you see that make maps, that make make all of these land cover products that we just take for granted in our everyday life. And they had this program that was to take the data and put it into applications. So we were specifically required to work with a natural resource management agency to bring NASA data into their process to help an agency with decision making. So it was really, in some respects, it was luck, and it was, in other respects, it was really good timing for us that this was well tailored to what NASA wanted to see, which is people using their data for management, and to the DNR's interest to make maps of animal patterns and distributions that cover the whole state.
And Jennifer, you said these pictures were going to be taken at 11 o'clock in the morning every day. How did you decide on 11 o'clock?
Yeah, just to clarify, there's one picture taken at 11 o'clock every day, and then pictures taken throughout the day anytime wildlife walks in front of the camera.
So it gets triggered as it goes.
Right. So it gets triggered by motion and heat activation of the animal. So most of the pictures that are taken are these motion-triggered photos, and that's when we're going to get photos of the animals. But the 11 o'clock photo, that's the time-lapse one, and that's to link up with some of the NASA side of the project, again, when some satellites are going over Wisconsin at that same time. And so to link the overview view data from the on-the-ground view, that's the 11 o'clock.
And I know that the state is particularly interested in data on deer. How do you expect this data to be used in decisions and policy about Wisconsin's deer herd, Phil?
Yeah, definitely. So deer is a primary motivation for this project in deer monitoring. And recently, the DNR has gone to looking at deer more on a county level, and the county deer advisory councils are integral in that process. And so Snapshot Wisconsin will be providing data to these county deer advisory councils that will help them understand the deer herd in their own county. And one of the metrics that Snapshot Wisconsin will provide is a fawn-to-doe ratio metric, and that will be by looking at the photos during a certain time of the year, August and September, namely, and finding out how many fawns are in the photos and how many does are in the photos and calculating this ratio. And that gives us an idea of recruitment in the deer herd. So it helps us understand how the deer herd may grow each year or might stay the same. And then it'll help the county deer advisory councils then potentially recommend quotas for harvesting a number of deer in that county.
I'd love to hear what the two of you are most excited to see once these cameras start going, you start getting photos.
Well, from my perspective, I'm interested in seeing all the different types of wildlife that we're going to find across the state. And, you know, the particularly exciting part of it are uncommon animals or you know, animals that we might not have expected to see in some places. There are all sorts of things. There really hasn't ever, to my knowledge, been something that will blanket the state the way this will. And then the other thing is sometimes just looking at the pictures can be a lot of fun because you'll see a lot of interesting behaviors by these animals, and they don't know they're being filmed, and sometimes they do silly things in these pictures.
And Jennifer, what about you?
I agree with Phil. All those things are incredibly exciting about the project. And then an additional one is working with volunteers to achieve this. That's a really unique part of this and something that this project just simply wouldn't be achievable without the help of volunteers, eventually from all across the state, for helping to put up trail cameras and then all across the world to help classify photos.
And Jennifer, just briefly as we wrap up, if someone wants to get involved, well, what can they do?
Yes, right now in Iowa and Sawyer County and educators from across the state, go to snapshotwisignup.org to sign up to host your own trail camera, or anybody can go to snapshotwisconsin.org to classify photos.
Well, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jennifer Stengline and Phil Townsend talking about their involvement in Snapshot Wisconsin, a project focused on tracking state wildlife using trail cameras.
A lot of us feel overwhelmed from time to time. We're juggling work, family, and friends. We get emails at all hours of the day and have gadgets that are extensions of ourselves. Sometimes it's enough for us to seek some sort of escape to recharge ourselves.
Hiking through the woods, walking along a beach, camping out under the stars. Those are familiar images when you think of getting away and recharging your batteries. But some new research suggests that those restorative benefits might be overstated. According to our next guest, if life has you overwhelmed, turning to nature isn't a one-size-fits-all solution to rejuvenate yourself. In fact, if you're a more neurotic person, nature might be the last place you'd like to be.
Joining us now is Kevin Newman. He's an assistant professor focusing on consumer behavior at Providence College School of Business. He recently co-authored research on how different personalities find different kinds of environments, urban, rural, you name it, restorative. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, this the norm, the thing we keep hearing is we got to get out in nature. It's good for our mental health. We have nature deficit. Is that true at least for some people? Some people do benefit from just getting out in a quiet, natural setting.
That's true. So we looked at kind of this idea of environmental compatibility. And there are certainly groups of people who would be beneficial for that. And I think we have kind of an inherent cultural bias to focus on the natural environment. And there's the idea of biophilia, which means we kind of have this human preference for potentially between humans and other living systems, including nature. So we see it in writing, Henry David Thoreau, you know, talking about Walden, you know, where you should go on vacation. People might typically say a beach. So I think it's pretty inherent in our culture that nature is kind of king.
So what made you want to question that assumption about people really connecting on some sort of elemental level with nature?
Well, my co-author and I, so Mary Brooks, we both like nature, but it kind of turns out we like different kinds of nature. So where she, I think, prefers the kind of calming, relaxing walk, I think I'm more on the side of preferring kind of the anxiety types of, you know, hikes or something, you know, zip lining, something a little more kind of anxiety inducing potentially. So I think part of it's kind of personal. And then the other side of it is, I think whenever you see something that's that kind of one-sided of the nature is kind of king, and this idea of nature almost versus kind of urban, there's got to be some kind of role potentially for these urban environments beyond just not being as good.
Right. The assumption is that the noisy urban setting, the traffic, the crowds, things like that, that's what we need to get away from. But it turns out, maybe according to research, that some personalities actually find that, I don't know if it's relaxing is the word, but restorative. What kind of people would lean toward more that noisy, stimulus-filled urban environment?
That's a good question. So we looked at maybe groups of people who might be, I would say maybe relatively comfortable processing kind of anxiety cues or something potentially that's a little more stressful in nature. And we looked at personality. So there's five, they call it the big five. There's five personality traits. And one of them is called neuroticism. Neuroticism is kind of defined, it's a personality trait associated with anxiety, worry, negative emotions, inability to kind of regulate those emotions. So generally it's not a great one to have. If you're going to have any of the big five, neuroticism isn't always the best, but they do have, I think, slightly more comfortable processing these kind of potentially cues and versus maybe those on the lower end of the kind of neuroticism scale. So we kind of looked at, again, going back to maybe environmental compatibility, that there's a potential maybe place for these higher neurotic types of people who might be maybe more comfortable in these type of environments.
So when you talk about that type of personality, you mentioned Woody Allen. So to play that out, would it be that a mind that is used to turning in on itself, thinking, ruminating, worrying, would like the clamor of the zip lining or the stressful mountain hike to drown out the internal voice?
So not 100% sure. So in terms of what is exactly going on, we found that they, when they are exposed to kind of pictures of anxiety-inducing environments or birds, we actually even had some associated with music, they tended to have kind of restore this kind of mental fatigue or this kind of self-control. I think it's more comfortable, like I said, it's more of a match, I think, with their personality, that they're kind of more suited for these type of environments, more used to it, potentially, these type of environments, and they might pay maybe slightly less attention to these type of environments. So it's maybe almost less jarring in some sense.
We're talking to Kevin Newman from the Providence College School of Business about what kind of environment different people need to restore themselves, not necessarily relax, but to recharge their batteries. The assumption a lot of times is it's nature, a peaceful walk in nature. He says for some people, especially with more what are called neurotic personality traits, maybe it's a noisy urban setting or maybe it is nature, but noisier, more adventurous nature, more stimulating nature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of environment do you need to recharge the batteries, to get away from it all? Kevin, I wanted to talk a little more. You started to touch on the methods. How did you try to measure the impact of these different environments on these different people?
Sure. So the first thing we had to do is kind of to figure out how it impacted them, is deplete them, kind of make them mentally fatigued, in essence. And then we exposed them to these different. One study was primes or words associated with these different environments. So maybe exposing them to words that like green or nature or urban or cities or buildings, and then and also some of them were exposing them to pictures associated maybe with an animal that's kind of scary, maybe like a growling lion versus maybe a lion that's sleeping, and then measure kind of their self-control. So there's different ways of doing that, but one of them was, for instance, like a budgeting task and how well they might budget planning for a future vacation, whether they would put more money on a credit card, for instance, or whether they would put less or more money on this kind of credit card. So we kind of depleted them and see, can they recover? Can they restore themselves after being exposed to these different environments?
And overall, I mean, what were the findings again? Were you surprised by what you saw there, given what we think we know about humans and nature?
I think it was a little surprising, to be honest, because I think you could go both ways, potentially. You could kind of think that maybe those high in neuroticism who are potentially and better in urban environments, but they also, the interesting part of the study is that they might also be better in maybe stressful or more anxiety-inducing natural environments. So it kind of breaks down this urban nature thing to look at more what's inherent in the environment. So is it these anxiety kind of cues that are in it or more of these kind of calming cues? And part of me, was surprised because you might think that the people who are most neurotic or these stressful people might kind of need that break, right? That they might kind of need, if anyone needs that type of kind of break or calming experience going to a beach, it would be people like that. Whereas we kind of found, I think, in some sense that more of the kind of Woody Allen, that he actually has a saying, he said, "I'm two with nature," which was kind of a joke with the people who say, "I'm one with nature." because of this kind of idea that I think people who are neurotic, I think someone like him might recognize that maybe it is beneficial. So I think it was somewhat surprising.
I wonder how we take this into account in our personal lives, because I don't know if a lot of people walk around knowing whether they're a neurotic personality trait. Some people do, I guess, but how do we figure out, how do we become matchmakers to figure out what kind of environment is going to help us get back to full mental energy?
Sure. So, I mean, if people, I think, love to go on WebMD and self-diagnose themselves, so you can actually go online and take a neuroticism scale, and I think you could potentially, if, as long as you're honest with yourself, so I think neuroticism tends to have kind of a negative reputation, so I think if you were to answer the questions honestly, which are questions such as, does your mood go up and down, do you feel miserable for no reason, do you often feel fed up, would you call yourself a nervous person? Are you a worrier? So questions like that would potentially indicate higher or lower levels of neuroticism. So I think you could take it yourself. And the other interesting thing is neuroticism tends to geographically segment. So potentially, in terms of even like marketing implications, there's certain parts of kind of the country that tend to have pockets of neuroticism. Which is potentially interesting if you know where you are.
I'm curious about the length of exposure. What if a neurotic person who falls under this designation at first has these particular responses that would seem to indicate that, no, they don't want relaxing at the seaside vacation, they want something else, but continued exposure, maybe they just need more time to unravel than the people who are not as neurotic.
Right, and so it's an interesting question because part of it is wondering the long-term exposure to something that is anxiety-inducing, if that is troublesome in some way. So there is some research for people who are exposed to kind of urban city environments, so urban public housing. And so these types of people might be exposed to something, these types of stressors for long, continuous periods of time. So some of that research which shows that they're kind of are more mentally fatigued. So I think, you know, there's some moderation, I guess, is needed in some sense, that you probably wouldn't want to constantly be exposed to these anxiety kind of environments. But to do it at times, I think, could be potentially beneficial.
We're talking right now with Kevin Newman, assistant professor at Providence College School of Business, about how the restorative benefits of spending time in nature might be different for different people, might be overstated for some people, especially more neurotic personalities.
We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. So do you fit what people assume is the normal mold? Does getting out to nature help you relax, recharge your batteries? What kind of nature? Is it a quiet stroll and a quiet path in the woods, or is it rock climbing, whitewater rafting, something really exciting, adrenalizing, stimulating? And do you find noisy city environments overwhelming, stressful, or do you feel at home there? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with Kevin Newman about using nature to recharge and rejuvenate ourselves and how it might not be for everyone in the ways that we think it is.
And now here's our question for you. You're overwhelmed with your work life, your daily life. What is the ideal environment? If you could magically teleport anywhere or just step out and find what you need, what is it that you need to bring yourself back home? Is it a quiet walk in the woods? Is it rafting on a raging river? Is it rock climbing? Is it walking down a busy city street? Is it looking at a farmscape in Wisconsin? Where is it? What is your recharging terrain? Where would you go? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post, paint us a picture on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Kevin, earlier you mentioned that there may be pockets of neurotic people who prefer the more active, more city-like sort of scenario for rejuvenating themselves. Where are those pockets of neurotic people? Are we talking city folk here? Is that what we're getting at?
No. It's interesting. It's not necessarily big cities as you might expect. I mean, it is. There are big cities that have this, but the typical one I think you would probably guess is New York. So when we're looking at the places I think with the most highest levels of neuroticism, it'd be where I am, actually, New England and kind of mid-Atlantic region.
Hmm.
So if you're looking at that region, so New York, kind of New Jersey, these type of places, you tend to have these kind of higher levels. If you look at so where you guys are in the Midwest, it's actually pretty low. In general. So it's very different kind of types of environment. So I wouldn't be surprised if your callers or if other people were more leaning towards that kind of nature side of things.
Well, let's find out. We've got Deb on the line starting us off in Appleton. Deb, hi.
Hi. Yeah, hi. I was thinking about this earlier. The weekend I was at Pottawatomie State Park going through that park, and I thought, man, I just feel so refreshed. Among the trees, so definitely in the woods. Love it.
And Deb, if you are having a rough day at home or work or something like that, you're feeling like just a little too much on my mind, is that what you picture? Is that the happy place you go to mentally and if able physically?
Yeah, if I could physically. But yeah, definitely that would be where I'd go.
And I don't know if you've done a self-diagnostic test, Deb, but do you consider yourself neurotic at all?
I don't think so. I think I used to be probably a little more neurotic, but kids are grown and I've filled a lot.
So there's hope for us.
Yeah, the kids are grown, less neurosis. Thank you so much, Deb, for sharing that with us. So she, Kevin, it sounds like fits a lot of the profiles of the people you talk to in your research.
Correct, yeah. So it doesn't surprise me, like I said, because I would think most callers who are from that region might prefer that kind of lower end of the kind of more nature side if they're on the lower end of the neuroticism scale.
Deb, thanks for that call. We're going to go next to Tony in Fenimore. Hi, Tony.
Hello. I'm not neurotic, but my recharge point is a star-filled night laying in the grass.
That sounds pretty nice. Tony, thanks for that image. And, you know, is there anyone out there who's going to, first of all, Kevin, cop to being neurotic, and second of all, who says, no, I hate nature, I want to be in the traffic? I mean, do people know this about themselves?
And that's the interesting part, I think, where this research maybe would like to maybe pursue in the future, is do people even know this, or would people even select kind of the appropriate environment for themselves? So, you know, even would I admit in the first place? So I think that's a good, important question, because I don't know if people want to admit that they're anxious or they're worried or they're, because it is tied to depression. It's tied to higher divorce rates. It's tied to some unfortunate things linked to neuroticism. So I think in general, you don't want people, maybe people would kind of underrepresent themselves or not represent themselves accurately. But I think it would be important to know that and to get yourself in that appropriate environment. And I'm not sure if they would self-select into that appropriate environment, which is kind of the more interesting question.
Thanks a lot for that call. I wonder if there's sort of a situational thing for people, because a lot of times I definitely get the, I need a quiet place, a little green would be nice. But there are some times where, I don't know, when I need a certain kind of focus, a certain kind of productivity, I want noisy music, a noisy coffee shop or some other environment. It turns into a background white noise and really, really helps me focus. So maybe people aren't all one or the other, Kevin.
Right. And I think it depends on what you're doing. And I think, you know, research does show, I think there's an optimal level of stress, right? So if you have a little bit or a moderate amount of stress, it can help you kind of perform better. But obviously, if you get too extreme, it actually makes your performance worse. So I think maybe it depends on, but maybe the particular thing you're going for, I guess, in some sense.
Let's take another caller now. Jonah joins us next in Milwaukee. Hi, Jonah.
Hey.
What's your preference?
Well, I just got out of some really bad traffic, and I actually was getting pretty anxious. So I took an exit and just stood around on one of the farms with the grass just blowing in the wind. And that was the perfect white noise, as I said before.
That sounds great, too, Jonah. Thanks for that. And Jonah has, you know, said he's not neurotic. He was feeling neurotic when he was in traffic. So how do you process that one, Kevin?
No, I think, again, maybe this goes back to extreme maybe amounts of kind of anxiety or something. I don't know if it'd be really beneficial for anyone. And then you might be getting into, I don't know if he's angry, but, you know, if you're getting angry or you're having some of these maybe very extreme emotions, it might not be good for really anyone.
All right, thanks a lot for the call, Jonah. Doug is with us next in Trevor. Doug, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, my place to go is my backyard. I can't afford to go anywhere else. My backyard calms me down. I'm not sure if I'm neurotic, but like your previous caller, with the driving, relationships at work, things just get stressful. And then just you go up in your backyard. I got a bird bath, you know, plant some bushes and flowers, and you just get outside, like the guy was saying, see the wind blow. And I'm not sure if I'm the neurotic part. I hope not, but that's where I would want to go. Yeah, not the Grand Canyon in my backyard.
Doug, thanks for that. And no judgment for people who are neurotic, not a value judgment there. But thank you so much for sharing that. So, Kevin, I guess we're nailing it here in the Midwest. We are not one of these pockets of neuroticism that would benefit from more stimulation, a noisier background environment.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, too, is I think I'm not sure how many of these callers are in a kind of metro area, but we, you know, since, you know, 1960, you know, urban population's gone up from about 34% to 54%. So increasingly, people are moving into the cities, and people, especially millennials and the kind of younger generation. So, you know, this it gets interesting to see how this might be dynamic will play out. We have more and more people kind of putting themselves directly, potentially, in these kind of might be higher anxiety-inducing kind of urban environments.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. Really interesting.
Okay, thank you.
That's Kevin Newman. He's an assistant professor focusing on consumer behavior at Providence College, the School of Business. He talked to us about why some personalities find crowded urban spots relaxing while others might prefer being surrounded by nature. You can keep sharing your experiences, your happy places, the place you need to go to recharge. Maybe a picture if you're there right now listening. And a radio is involved, I guess, and you're recharging. Send it to us on the Central Time Facebook page. I don't know. I think of myself as a person who likes that nature and likes it to recharge. I don't always get out there, though.
I love to get out there. It totally. I can walk into a, you know, Indian lake where I like to go, just feel the trees, the wind, and whoosh, it all goes away.
A little waterfall action, a little stream, babbling brook. That really does. I should get some of those noise generators that just make those sounds. That's what I need.
We all need
We're
that.
Getting
Serenity
one in the office.
Fountain.
Serenity Fountain in the office. It's happening, people.